I'm Anita Lustria, and this is Faith Conversations. Today, I am delighted to have Peter Enns on the podcast, someone I've been looking forward to talking with for a long time, actually many years. His book, The Bible Tells Me So, is one that I highly recommend. Today, we're going to focus in on the sin of certainty, why God desires our trust more than our correct beliefs. Oh, yeah, there's a boatload just in that title. So who knows how far we'll actually get in the conversation today. But buckle up, because I know some of you are in this same place where I find myself asking some questions. And the beauty is it's okay to ask those questions. And you're in good company, everybody. So we're going to talk with Peter about that today. Just a reminder that you have been so helpful in helping me get the word out about Faith Conversations. Every time you share the new release on Mondays on your Facebook page, that helps immensely. And I've seen that boost in folks that are downloading the podcast. And you can do that either from iTunes or Stitcher, but tell a friend. And again, thank you so much for doing that and helping to get the word out. Well, let me introduce my guest today, Peter Enns. He is the Abram S. Clemens Professor of Biblical Studies at Eastern University. If you're unfamiliar, that's in St. David's, Pennsylvania. And Peter speaks at schools, churches, seminars, conferences, all of that across the country. He's a frequent contributor to journals and encyclopedias. That sounds all academic, but the guy is really down to earth, and his writing is so accessible, and I'm grateful for that. And I already mentioned his book, The Bible Tells Me So. He's also written Inspiration and Incarnation and the Evolution of Adam. Fantastic writer. And Peter, thank you so much for taking the time to join me on Faith Conversations.
Thank you, Anita, for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Well, you're hitting me two things, where it hurts and where I am, both.
You mean metaphorically, I don't.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly.
Okay, good.
I have to say, as I've started to read your book, and I'm only a few chapters in, I already have underlined a lot, and I probably will read a few quotes today, if you don't mind. But I love where you began, and wouldn't mind if you would tell that story, even if it's embarrassing, about the Walt Disney movie that kind of turned your faith on end a little bit.
Well, yeah. See, here's the thing. I sort of, this actual thing that happened to me, I was on a flight back from some academic conference, I think in California, and there was, at that point, there were still in-flight movies. I didn't know what to watch. I felt like reading. I felt like being a vegetable. So I just said, this Bridge to Terabithia movie sounds interesting. It was a Disney movie. What can happen? And I just watched it, and I wound up having this faith crisis on an airplane watching a Disney movie, because there was this scene between three kids. I mean, some you know, I'm sure many of the viewers, listeners, actually probably know the story, at least because it was a, you know, well-known book beforehand. It's a story of this boy, Jess, and he has a sister, Maybelle, and they're from sort of fundamentalist families, nice kids, nice family, but very, very strict sort of black and white view of their Christian faith. And they meet this girl who's Jess's age. They're fifth graders. Her name is Leslie. And she has no clue. I mean, she's just sort of like a hippie. You know, her parents are really, you know, progressive and all that. And she sort of loosens Jess up a little bit, because she just models a very different way of living. She's always game for anything. She's never sad, just always really just curious about life and this and that. And one day there's a scene where they're coming back from church, because Jess had invited Leslie to come to church, and she'd love to because she's game for anything. It's just another adventure. And she comes back, and they're talking about how she really enjoyed the experience, and she thinks Jesus is very interesting and attractive and beautiful. And, you know, she really didn't like the hellfire and brimstone preaching, but she said the rest of it, you know, it's really pretty interesting. At that point, Maybelle, the little sister, who's sort of a spitfire, she says, "It's not interesting. It's scary. It's nailing holes through your hand. It's because we're all vile sinners that God made Jesus die." At which point, Leslie just looks at Maybelle like, you know, she just told her she believed babies were delivered by storks, and she says, "You don't actually think that, do you?" And they said, "Yeah, we have to believe it. It's in the Bible." And if you don't believe in the Bible, God sends you to hell. At that point, Leslie, this is the line that sort of got to me. And I wasn't even, like, ready for it. I wasn't paying attention. She said, I don't think that God is all about sending people to hell. He's too busy running all of this. And she looks up at the sky and, you know, the trees and the clouds, and it's a beautiful spring day. And I thought to myself, you know, it sounds like it may be a silly thing listening, you know, on a podcast, but for me, it was just that moment in my life where I thought to myself, you know, that's the kind of God I want to believe in. That's the kind of God I think deep down I probably do believe in, but that thought wasn't allowed to surface. And I was keeping it just subconsciously submerged, because you don't talk that way. You don't raise those kinds of questions about God. And that was just a moment among other moments years ago where I just became more conscious of how much energy I had been expending being a good boy, you know, and keep making sure the answers are right. And the idea is to be certain about what you believe in, and you don't waver in that certainty. And if doubts come up and if other ideas come up, you push them down, you ignore them, you run away, do whatever you have to do, but hold on to those certain ideas.
Well, because, to quote you, once you start down this path, there's no telling where the dominoes are going to fall. And then what?
Yeah, and that's if we're raised that way, yeah, in the faith, that's a big problem, right?
Yeah.
The thing is that maybe that's not the right way to think about, yeah, the nature of faith to begin with.
Yeah. And at the time, you were teaching where?
I was teaching at Westminster Theological Seminary, which is, yeah, in suburban Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of the year. It was probably, you know, the mid-2000s or so, maybe early mid-2000s when this happened on the airplane. But So that was, you know, Westminster, I always describe it at the time, was conservative but sane.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't out to get anybody. They were just pretty conservative, and yet, you know, just refreshingly progressive in some other areas. But still, you know, a very, very clearly laid out doctrine, mm-hmm, doctrinal system.
Yes.
Much more so than most people are probably used to. I mean, their statement of faith is a book. It's like 33 chapters long. It's huge.
Woo! Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. That's a lot to sign on to.
It's a lot.
Yeah. And, you know, you say, you know, right at the beginning of, I think, that opening chapter, I need to be willing to let go of what I think I know and trust God regardless. And that, you know, that alone for some maybe listening today to the podcast is a big enough statement just to chew on for a little bit.
Right.
And I'll just say for me, and sometimes we, you know, it's interesting, a Disney movie was maybe your crisis of faith moment, or, you know, I'm sure there were other more heady moments than just that one. But for me, I actually wrote in the margin in your chapter, can we just be honest for a second, please? And I wrote, you know, my divorce was my big one moment, at least the beginning, mm-hmm, the beginning of a journey for me. Like that word didn't exist, that, you know, everything was nice and buttoned down and in a pretty small box, but at any rate, it was contained in that box, and divorce wasn't something that was supposed to be in that box. And that sort of blew me out of the water and began probably the journey that I'm on today.
We all have something.
Yeah, we do, don't we?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So where do we go, though, from that moment, whatever it is for us, that moment when we start to grapple with the things we used to think were certain, and maybe even deciding, okay, maybe this certain way of living is actually not the best and not what God is calling us to. Where do we go from there? Because that can be really a frightening moment.
It is a frightening moment because, you know, again, I don't want to keep jumping into the same circle, but it's a vortex, and it's a true one. Letting go of certainty is frightening because we know we need to hold on to certainty.
Mm.
That's the problem, right? And so we keep coming back and circling back like, my goodness gracious, I used to be so certain about these seven things, and now I'm like completely unsure about four of them, and three of them I sort of have my doubts, and where do I go? What do I turn? Where do I turn? And the answer may be as simple as, you have to trust God. Yeah, but I need to be certain. No, you didn't listen to what I said. You have to trust God at that point, because we're not always certain. We're people. You know, and certainty comes and goes, but we can always make a decision whether or not we want to trust God, even if the quick answer and the resolution isn't right in front of our face and may not be there for some time.
But let me interject this. So for years I worked in Christian radio, and you know, most people listening probably know me from my days with Moody Radio, and you know, good times, lots of great relationships developed there, certainly. But I was surrounded by, and I think, you know, when we listen to a certain stream of evangelicalism, we can be surrounded by those who tell us that we have to be certain. And so, you know, when we're kind of in those circles, we also have additional voices besides the one that we're listening to in our own mind as we start to question, telling us, no, 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 bad, bad, bad. You cannot question. You have to stay certain.
Right. And that's a struggle I know that many people feel, which, I mean, I had that struggle too because of, you know, ecclesiastical and other sorts of communities that I was a part of. But there reaches a point where I think people have to make decisions.
Yes.
Whether that's maintaining that community where certainty is valued, whether that's more important than this, you keep, you know, metaphorically looking out the window saying, I wonder what's down there, because I think I have to go explore that. And we all have to make that decision. And it's hard to make that decision, especially when we feel like, okay, I'm losing my faith. I'm actually rejecting God. God's going to be mad at me. And I have to do this all by myself.
And
both of those things aren't true, in my opinion.
Thank you. I was just going to say, we feel in the moment that they are true, but they aren't true.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's helpful to say. I mean, you know,
it feels true because that's all we
know. Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
But the whole history of Christians who, like, have, you know, struggled with darkness and doubt, and it's just the way, you know, some people are more wired and geared towards that, some are less so, but it happens eventually, you know. And when that happens, you're not broken, you don't need to be fixed. You know, that's the thing that I think is very important for people to hear. You're not a bad person if you're saying, listen, I'm just not sure about this. I wish I were, but I'm not. That may be an opportunity for growth, not a reason to panic.
And I think sometimes when you come out and express some of this, which, you know, you have, I don't know how many years down the road in this at this point, but initially, not only is it frightening, but what's interesting, and you say in the book, since I have outed myself as someone who's okay with questions about the faith, I can't tell you the number of private conversations I've had with people, often virtual strangers, telling me about their secret questions and thoughts. And I wrote in the margin, and I'm sure other Christian leaders as well, because I've had some of those same questions. Because I think once we voice this out loud, we become a safe place for a different group of people.
Right. Yeah, you certainly do. And I think that's necessary, that's valuable. You know, even online communities, you know, email, even those are places where people just feel like there's somebody who understands me. And you know, I want to tell them, I think God understands you. Let's just start with that. You know, you don't have to go seeking places. What if God actually likes you and understands the process better than you do, and it's okay, and he's not looking over your shoulder to see whether you make a mistake on your theology exam?
Not looking over your shoulder and not chasing you with a baseball bat either.
Yes, that's true.
You know, either of those, which, depending on our constitution or our upbringing, we might have either one of those daydreams or whatever. So, you know, moving forward, you know, there's some that are listening today that are saying too, as this conversation is unfolding, that, okay, yeah, I've had that moment where, you know, I've come face to face with doubts and decided it was okay. But I think the deeper struggle can happen when what you talk about is when your faith just goes dark. And I think that is a deeper fear for some of us. What if we go down that path and that's what happens? Or is that actually what happens?
Well, it can. You know, there's no controlling. I think there are different levels of people doubting, or that can lead to a real despair. And I really think it's a matter of personality differences. We're all such different people. And, you know, I think of people like Mother Teresa, who had a, struggled with doubt on a very serious, dark level for, I think, something like 47 years.
Wow.
And I'm like, okay, that's almost as long as I've been alive. You know, that's a pretty long time. But not everyone's like that. And some people, they just don't have those same kinds of struggles. I think sometimes, this might be too simplistic, but maybe people who are oriented more towards an analytical mind,
mm-hmm.
and that doesn't mean schooling necessarily, it just means some people just have a more analytical mind, they may have more occasion to have these periods of doubt where things aren't making sense like they used to, things don't fit into the box as well as they used to, whereas some other people, their way of knowing isn't primarily or exclusively, let's say, analytical or
yes.
intellectual. It may be more intuitive. And I think some of those people have a different kind of, they may have different struggles, they probably do, but maybe not exactly the same kind.
Yeah. One of the things that you talk about is that there's a part of your spiritual life that really had atrophied over the past 20 years before talking about or before this crisis came along. And that was courage to think, to be honest, and just to be. And I guess I just wanted to get that out there because I think it's helpful to hear that from someone who's down the road a piece and to know that that may be something that God is inviting us into as we move on this journey as well. And also, I think the other thing that I wrote in a margin here too was that moving this direction also leaves room for mystery. When everything is so buttoned down and certain, there is no room for mystery. And God, if nothing else, is certainly mysterious.
Yeah.
I mean, he cannot fully be known as much as we try and move down that path and want to and desire to. There's got to be room for mystery.
Yeah, I always chuckle a little bit. I put it the same way you do frequently, but I always sort of chuckle a little bit. We'll say, we have to make room for mystery. Are you serious? Oh, we're going to, how much room? We're like 5%. How much room do you want to make? It's not a matter of making room for mystery. It's a matter of perceiving the mystery that is.
Mm.
And that's very different way of living. And that's not the typical, let's say, Protestant evangelical fundamentalist way, which I get. You know, I understand why. But it is a part of other expressions of the Christian faith that I think we can learn from, maybe. You know, that there are others for whom this conversation that we're having now, Anita, is like, yeah, well, of course, duh. You know, what else do you expect of the faith? Do you expect answers all the time? No, read the Bible, for heaven's sake. It's all over the place. You know, that's why, see, part of the despair and the dismay and the fear of losing a sense of certainty, again, I don't want to be simplistic, but that's you could chalk that up to sort of a Western social Christian context
mm-hmm.
where knowing what you believe is held up as like the highest, at least a very high ideal that Christians are supposed to mm-hmm. attain. The
yeah.
more spiritual you are, the more certain you are of what's out there, right?
Yeah, I mean, I see that all the time, that certainly that's held up, yeah.
Yeah.
Tell
me more about what you like about the book.
Yeah,
Anita.
I will. Well, you call this the sin of certainty, which, you know, some can think that's pretty strong. And even, be afraid of moving into this place where we are actually thinking our own thoughts about God. Because honestly, Peter, for years, I was used to only thinking other people's thoughts about God and rubber stamping other people's thoughts about
yeah.
God. And so I think that's where we get into the scary place of, okay, if I'm no longer certain, then what do I really think about God? And I hear the voices screaming at me listening to this going, what do you mean? What do you think about God? Who are you, right? And then we have that inner dialogue. Who am I to even think my thoughts about God? That's a part of the certainty
yeah.
movement, speaking.
It sure is. It's almost a shaming, you know?
Yes,
like,
good.
You know,
that's right.
You've got to stay in the tribe here, and who do you think you are going against what we say? Of course, you go down the street, and there's another tribe that has a different theology. They're saying the same thing to their people.
Right.
And I want to be clear, the book, you know, The Sin of Certainty. I'm not saying that feeling certain is sinful.
Right.
What I'm saying is that when you lose that sense of certainty, when we become preoccupied and obsessed with getting that old certainty back, that's the sinful part, because we're I think, working against a forward movement that, in my opinion, I say by faith that God wants. And that's something that's well documented among saints of old and of recent times. And the sin is wanting to hold on to the God of our minds, the one that we're comfortable with, the one that we agree with, the one who's under our control. That's the sin of certainty. It's not feeling certain.
And thank you for that clarification, too. I think that's important. And I would also say that some, depending on the stream of Christianity that a person grows up in, you know, you might struggle more than others. You know, I grew up in the word-centered tradition. Right. And so much is knowledge-based. And for me, I translate that to, you know, head-based. And God forbid that I think and feel something, you know?
Right.
And so I think that maybe some of us in that word-centered tradition might even have an especially hard time making this leap to thinking for ourselves, but also that feeling piece is not a sinful piece. And I'm personally really working on that right now and trying to allow tears even to stay close to the surface in my life, because I think that's actually an important piece for me in my relationship with God. That's me personally. It's going to look different for everyone.
It's going to look different, but I think that the emotional level is part of what makes us human. And people say, well, God doesn't have emotions. I'm like, man, first of all, you don't know that. Do you know? Are you certain? Secondly, just read the Bible. God has emotions all over the place, right? And it's you know,
well, and God incarnate too. You know, you right?
Exactly. Okay. I keep forgetting. Oh yeah, the Jesus part.
Thank you.
Right, but I mean, it's just, you know, emotions are, that's like a stoic thing. You know,
yes.
That's, you know, don't have a, kidding me? That's, you bottle them up, you start hurting people emotionally. You know.
So yes. Yes.
Emotions are part of who we are, and to, you know. People say, well, you shouldn't be subject to your fleeting emotions. I'm saying, no, maybe not, but I shouldn't be subject to my fleeting thinking either. Every part of us has that same problem, you know, that's that falls short of you know, complete apprehension of who God is.
Yeah. Well, okay, so confession here. One of the things I love about talking with people like you is getting to read these great books. But the one thing I don't like is that I usually get just a few chapters read, and I don't want to breeze through a book like this. I want to actually spend time chewing on these chapters, partly because you're speaking to me where I am currently living. And so I've already gotten to all that I've read. So I want you to take us forward to what would be important for this conversation today.
For what would be important for this conversation,
yeah.
You mean in the rest of the book?
Or? Yeah, in the rest of the book. So, like, move us forward down even your personal timeline to a chapter or two that we need to talk about today in today's conversation.
Well, you know, I guess in the book itself, a couple places that I think are important. I look at the Bible and how, you know, characters in the Bible exhibit what we would call despair or doubt or the dark night of the soul, and they make no apologies for it. Mm-hmm. They actually get in God's face. This is the wonderful thing about the Old Testament. You know, they get in God's face about why God is not coming through the way he said that he would. And, you know, that's, oh, don't complain. Well, yeah, I'm going to complain. I'm seeing it all over the place. You see it in Lament Psalms and Job and Ecclesiastes and in places like that. So, in other words, you know, the Bible itself modeled something for us that's very important. You know, the Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann, he talks about the counter-testimony of Scripture. The main testimony is where things work out. Mm-hmm. The counter testimony is those biblical authors who say, but it's not working out. In fact, it's constantly not working out. And they sort of like, they push the matter into a very serious spiritual kind of dialogue. So there's biblical precedent for us, and I think that's very, very important.
Well, but why do we struggle going there? It's not that we don't hear sermons on the Psalms of Lament and some of these things, but or are they just too neatly wrapped up at the end and actually in the end don't encourage us personally to really go there? What is it? Why don't we?
Some of the Lament Psalms, definitely they sort of tidy things up sort of at the end. But some don't really. I mean, the two of them that I talk about are Psalm 88 and Psalm 89 that end, you know, Psalm 88 ends, "Darkness is my only friend."
Okay.
That's the end of the psalm. No tidying up anything, right?
Okay, yes.
Psalm 89 pretty much calls God a liar and just leaves it there.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Isn't that cool? So, because God promised that David would never cease having a descendant sitting on the throne in Jerusalem. And this writer is writing during or after the Babylonian exile, when there is no Jerusalem, there is no king, and there is no throne. And so he says, yeah, you promised, and look at this, you've rejected your people, you've rejected your king. What's up with that? You know, it's just, it's, you know, and we all have those moments. You know, the Bible, again, sort of, it models something that we don't have to go out of our way to copy. It just sort of happens to us when you're pretty sure that you know the character of God, and you're pretty sure something should happen next, and then it never does. And people keep waiting and waiting and waiting, and, you know, God seems dead to you, and you're in good company. There are people in the Bible who felt that too.
But people in current times are fearful of saying how they really feel, saying that they are there and identifying with those people in the Bible that felt that.
Right.
Somehow today it's scary to say it out loud, depending on the friendship groups that you find yourself in,
right.
I suppose, right?
Because you can be ostracized pretty quickly. See, this is hard because sometimes the answer is find a new community. But that's hard to do because you have friends and you have a history there and you're close to people. But see, this is why I wish churches could be places where we could be honest and we wouldn't be ostracized for speaking what we're actually experiencing.
Mm.
And not letting that be a threat to the community. And I think ideally that's what church should be. But, you know, when you center a church around being certain, knowing what you believe, it is hard to tolerate people. And they look at you like, you know, you're just weird now, and we can't trust you, we can't have dinner together like we used to. That stuff actually happens. You can't teach Sunday school anymore, you certainly can't watch our kids anymore, right?
Yeah.
And it's this whole process, and that happens. It's very, very, very common. And, you know, so what does somebody do who really feels like I've got to say something to somebody? You know, Psalm 73 has the same problem. The author says, you know, he's lamenting how God doesn't follow through on his own plan. You know, the righteous are supposed to prosper and the wicked are supposed to be punished. He says the wicked are prospering all over the place and the righteous have a hard time of life. So what's up with that? And he says, you know, when I tried, if I had spoken like this, I would have betrayed your children. If I had spoken up about this, I would have freaked people out. But when I tried to understand all this, it became oppressive to me. In other words, he couldn't speak anything, and he couldn't just keep it in anymore. And so his solution is to go to the temple. In other words, his solution is to bring the problem right to God in this very honest moment. That may not be bad advice for us, too.
And
if our problem is with God, go to God. God, he can handle it.
Yeah. I mean, and I think
we
hear that and see that in these Psalms of Lament, and you know, I read it in blogs, other places, that, you know, and even hear it from the pulpit. God can handle it. You know, take it to God. I think our bigger problem is, yeah, but our close circle of friends and family might not be able to handle it.
And sometimes our pastor.
Yeah, I think that's can be our bigger struggle point. And so, you know, I guess to counter that, and I'm grateful I go to a church that can handle it, but I'll say this, I started a conversation group in my home where we bring topics together, and part of it is to even say at the outset, hey, we might not always agree, and that's
right.
Okay.
Right.
Because I think, in current day, especially places, you know, many places in more conservative evangelicalism, you've got to look like, talk like, act like, and agree exactly like, believe exactly like I do, to right. even be in relationship. And I think that's not a message that right. is perpetuated in Scripture, if I'm not right. mistaken.
Yeah. It's not relevant, I think.
So. Yeah, that's a, yeah. And so I, you know, I think one of my small ways, one of the things I've done is to have these conversation groups where we do talk mm-hmm. in depth about a variety of topics and thoughts and where we might have a lot of questions and struggle right. and someone there might be certain about something, but the next person might not be. And we're right. okay with that at the end of the night.
Yeah, so you're creating a community.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's sort of, you know, what probably has to happen. Some people have to take the bull by the horns and just create cultures and create communities within a church where you can do that. But of course, you know, sometimes if people find out about that, then you're in trouble there too. So,
well, and
I just found myself having to leave certain contexts and okay. go someplace else, you know.
That's what I was wondering, you know, in the end, how, and there will be some pain involved. I mean, that is an inevitability yeah. as well.
Right, exactly right. I mean, we've missed, you know, watching kids in church grow up. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's you know, that's hard, but I felt like it was difficult, but I felt like I don't have a choice. Mm-hmm. I can't go on like this. You know, I can stay here and play a game with myself, or I can do a frightening thing, an uncomfortable thing, and say, I have to seek God some other way. Mm. Not that this way is necessarily wrong. That's not the issue. The issue right. is, for me, it's not happening.
Let me ask this question, and I don't know if you address this in the book or not, and this is not a specific issue, struggle that I have, but I know.
You know somebody, right?
I know somebody. And truly,
it's not me, it's a friend.
Seriously,
okay,
seriously, no, it's not my issue. But what if you're not on the same page in your marriage? I think that can be a very real thing.
Yeah.
Where you start moving down this path, but your spouse is not on the same journey.
Well, I think it's too much to expect spouses to be on the same journey at the same moment.
Yeah.
Always, anyway, right? So
yeah,
I think
that's good. That's true.
That's unrealistic to sort of suggest that. But I think, regardless of whether the two are on a different point in the journey, just respecting and loving each other and allowing them to be who they are, well, that's really frightening for the, you know, the spouse who might be more comfortable in the certainty thing, and the other one's like, I'm not certain right now. But yeah. that's where self-sacrificial love, that's where the other comes first.
Yeah,
you know, that's this is like every other sentence in Paul's letters, you know, about humility and thinking more of the other person, bearing the burdens of mm-hmm. others, right? And
yes.
not just like, you have to pass my theology test or we're not going to get along, you know. And it was all about theology, too. For Paul, it was about whether mm-hmm. Jews and Gentiles can eat together, whether kosher laws, you know, dietary restrictions are still a thing that hold or whether they don't. And that's that was a very serious theological issue in Paul's day. It's not just little things. It's actually very central things that people disagreed with. And you have to stay together anyway.
Boy, that's a great example to pull forward. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah. Well, I could talk on and on this topic and with you here. But that might be a good place to draw things to a close. And I'm just going to say, because I want to go on record, I just want to say my 23-year-old has loved your writing, and he will listen to this and tell me all the questions I should have asked that I didn't. So then that's what I get with a PhD student as a kid, and that's okay. But Peter, thank you, and I hope we can have some other conversations down the road a piece after I read a little further. And I personally want to go back and complete reading your book, The Bible Tells Me So, because that's another very important conversation that we need to have.
Yeah, let's do that. I'd be happy to do that. It'd be a lot of fun.
All right. Well, thank you. Yeah. You've been listening to Faith Conversations, and I'm Anita Lustria.